Hebrews chapter 9, 11 through 12. Neither by the blood of the goats, but Christ being come in the high priest of good things, to come by a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands. This is to say, not of this building, neither by the blood of the goats and calves, but by his own blood he entered in once the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption for us.
Good job, Caden. Thank you. We start in Hebrews chapter 9, verse 1 tonight. Then indeed, even the first covenant had ordinances of divine service in the earthly sanctuary. I wasn't able to be in class Wednesday night here. I was in one of the other classes, and so I don't know how much Mark might have touched on this. You know that we're overlapping some in study of comparisons or typology. To bring some things down to the level that I can understand, let me just say this. When I was first starting to preach, I remember one of the first tips that I got from anybody, and that person was not a preacher. That person was my father, but he said, you have to use a lot of comparisons and contrasts. Well, that's basically what typology is. Not that Mark hasn't done a great job explaining that on Wednesday nights. I just thought I'd throw that in there. You're comparing something. To teach, you need some kind of comparison. Sometimes something is similar to another thing. Sometimes it's quite different, and so you can use it as a contrast. In the book of Hebrews, we're comparing the old law to the new law. We've learned that the old law needs to the new law in every respect. But in every respect, the new law is better. Christ is better than the angels that helped deliver the old law. Christ is better than Moses, the mediator of the old law. The priesthood of Christ, after the order of that ancient character, pre-law character, Melchizedek, is better than the priesthood of the old law, the Levites, because those folks died every once in a while. Well, they all died. And they could have compassion on people because they were weak. But Christ has compassion on us, not because he died, not because he was weak, but because he was tempted in all points as we are, yet did not sin. Then the effects of the tabernacle, the effects of the temple, the things that were in the temple come into view starting in chapter 8, after we sort of make a turn where the main point in chapter 8, verse 1, is that we have such a high priest as Christ, and then chapter 8 verses 8 through 12 speaks of a passage from the Old Testament, Jeremiah 31, that tells us that God was always planning to have a new covenant, a new testament, which he would give to people by which he would rule them. But still, everything in that old covenant, or at least a lot of things that God designed in that old covenant, had some specific purpose to tell us something about this new covenant. I can't get too detailed. I don't know that everything that I would mention is a particular type or a particular comparison, but the overall picture certainly is. If you were to imagine that this coming in this direction from my right hand and your left would be east, I know that's not actually geographically correct here, but for the sake of illustration, let's do that. At least I got a 3/4 chance of that not being actually correct. If you're coming in from the east here, you would come to the tabernacle courts or the temple courts, and there'd be an outer court, and there'd be an altar of burnt offering where most of the offerings were given at that time, and then there'd be a laver after that. And then when you got a little bit closer, you'd come to the enclosed structure that contained the holy place, wherein if you entered, you would see on the right side or the north side of it, the table of showbread, where certain pieces of bread were there because of God's instructions. You would see to your left a lampstand, as the Jews have today, a menorah. It had 6 branches and then one in the middle. And that was made out of hammered gold, all of one piece. And then you would see in front of you the altar of incense that was overlaid with gold, or the golden altar of incense. And behind that golden altar of incense, if you kept progressing toward the west, there would be the veil where you had the veil that was ripped when Christ died from top to bottom, the veil that was into the most holy place where the Ark of the Covenant was kept. And the Ark of the Covenant was about 2.5 cubits by 1.5 cubit by 1.5 cubit, or a little over 3 feet by a little over 2 feet in each direction. And it was overlaid with gold, and it had on top of it the mercy seat, where there were 2 cherubim that were facing each other. We don't know exactly what those looked like. We don't have a record of what those looked like, but apparently God explained it to them well enough to make something of it. And then in the temple, later on, there were actually large cherubim that extended from one wall to the other with their wings spread out towards each other. That's the outline that you had of the temple. Now keep that in mind as you read chapter 9, verses 1 through 5. Here's the instruction that we get of glory, God's glory. Then indeed, even the first covenant had ordinances of divine service and the earthly sanctuary. That is worship to God, divine service. But it's the earthly sanctuary. For a tabernacle was prepared. Now he's writing this about 64 to 66 AD, somewhere in there, when Herod's temple was in Jerusalem, and that was where the Jews went for worship. Before that, there was Zerubbabel's temple that was built after the captivity, about 536 to 516 BC. And before that, there was Solomon's temple that was destroyed in 586 BC by the Babylonians. Those all were modeled after the original tabernacle, but none of them were exactly like the original. They had the same furniture and the same kinds of ideas, but the measurements were a little bit different in each one. And so Herod's temple was the one that would be destroyed in just a few years by the invading Roman armies in 70 AD. Why doesn't the Hebrews writer then mention the temple instead of the tabernacle? Because this is the brilliance of God. Some of the very orthodox Jews would say, hey, this is not like what God gave us. The dimensions are just a little bit different. This is not exactly like the tabernacle. We don't have the ram skins dyed with wool and the ram skins and dyed red and all of that. We don't have all of that with this movable tabernacle that we had originally. It's not exactly like that. And so to make the comparison that he wants to make, the Hebrews writer goes all the way back to the original pattern, the tabernacle. Instead of Herod's temple, instead of Zerubbabel's temple, instead of Solomon's temple, he goes back to Moses' tabernacle, which was built specifically down to the cubit, down to the inch, if you will, to the instructions given by God. Remember last week we studied in Exodus 25 and 26 that recurring phrase that you should make it according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. Now this says something to us about the New Testament church. I know that didn't get through verse 5 yet, but bear with me. That if we want to, as preachers have aimed to do and elders have aimed to do for some time now, if we want to get back to the New Testament church, the way God intended for his church to be, the church that Christ built, that he said he would build and that he did build and that he purchased with his blood, Acts chapter 20, verse 28. If we want to get back to that, we don't go back to what the church was like in the 1950s. And we don't go back to what the church was like in the 1820s. And we don't go back to what the church was like in the 1500s. And we don't go back to what the church was like in the 500s. We go back to what the church was like in the New Testament in that first 100 years. Now, there will be points of difference that are matters of opinion. They didn't have buildings in the first century yet. We do. They met daily because they were under persecution and had some specific circumstances. It's not incumbent upon us to meet daily. The elders tell us that it's a good practice for us to meet Sunday night and Wednesday night in addition to the Lord's Day morning, and so we listen to their judgment and we do that. But those things were not a part of the New Testament church specifically. Meeting was. When was determined by judgment, except to the instruction that you had to do at least the meeting, the gathering together, the assembly on the Lord's Day for the worship that was prescribed at that time. But we want to go back, and we don't want to be organized any other way. We don't want to be organized like the church might have been made up by man in the 1950s or the 1820s or the 1500s or the 400s. And we don't want to teach a plan of salvation that was invented in the 1830s and 1840s, like the sinner's prayer was invented about then, I believe, if my history is right. We don't want to teach a plan of salvation that was based upon something in the 1500s. That's what Martin Luther reacted against. The Catholic Church was selling the forgiveness of sins at that time. Supposedly you could buy the forgiveness of sins of you and your loved ones, alive or deceased, if you had enough money. We don't want to teach that kind of stuff that man came up with. We want to go back to the original pattern. That's always the wisest thing to do, and it's what God demands of us. Throughout the New Testament, he gave those warnings not to add to or take from his word. Revelation 22, 18 and 19 is a passage that caps it all off. We want to go back to the original pattern. Well, here in Hebrews, the writer is going back to the original pattern. For a tabernacle was prepared, the first part, This would be the holy place where you came in from the east after you had the altar, burnt offering, and the laver. The first part, in which was the lampstand, the table, and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary, a holy place. And behind the second veil, the part of the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all, the most holy place, or the holiest, or the holy of holies, depending on your translation. They all mean the same thing. This is where man was not supposed to go, not even the priests. This is where only the high priest could go once a year. We'll talk about that more a little bit later. And that only with God's particular instruction so that he did not die. Now, there's a little bit of a textual consideration here when he says that it is behind the second veil. People wonder, what is the second veil? I thought there was only one veil. Well, in the original instructions for the tabernacle, if you're using the word veil, there was only one veil, and that was what separated the holy place and the most holy place. But there was also a screen that separated the courts from the rest of the world, the tabernacle proper from the rest of the world. There was a screen that was designed in that way, and I don't know if he's referring to that as the first veil and this the second veil. Another suggestion has come about that he actually talks about the second veil as the original, because in Herod's temple there would have been two veils. The Jewish historians tell us that when Herod's temple was built, they were trying to make the holy place the number of cubits that they thought the former temple was, and the most holy place the number of cubits that they thought that former temple was. And there was a discrepancy. They couldn't decide if this one cubit belonged to the holy place or the most holy place. So when they built Herod's temple, they made the fullness of the holy place with that cubit and the fullness of the most holy place with that cubit. And in between the two, they put a cubit just for good measure, and they had a first veil and then a second veil. I don't know if that's the reference here or not. I kind of tend to think that would be the idea, because Hebrew readers at that time would understand, hey, there are two veils in this temple, but hey, we understand he's talking about the original, and that second veil, as we know it, would have been the veil that God ordained. So I don't know about all that, but the point is still clear. There's a sanctuary with the table of showbread, the lampstand, and the altar of incense, and then there's the veil and the Ark of the Covenant. Verse 4 goes on to name the other things, which had, this holiest of all, which had the golden censer and the Ark of the Covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had the manna, Aaron's rod that budded, in the tablets of the covenant. Above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things we cannot now speak in detail. Well, it's given enough detail to confuse a lot of authors, because he says the golden censer, or as it's translated in many translations, the golden altar of incense. That wasn't in the most holy place, it was in the holy place, but it's represented here as if it was in the most holy place. The Truth for Today commentator Pace had this explanation of that. He said that when the high priest would go into the most holy place on the Day of Atonement, one day a year, he would always have to go in with lots of incense, and so there would be lots of incense coming from that altar, and then he would have to take a censer and take that incense into the Ark of the Covenant. There'd be a cloud so that he would not die. It would appear to an observer standing a safe distance back, when you pulled back the veil, it just might appear as if that altar of incense was a part of the most holy place. That's not a totally satisfactory explanation to me, but at least it's some sort of explanation. At any rate, if there's any kind of problem here, we know it's on our part and it's not on God's part through inspiration. It's my lack of understanding and not God's lack of understanding. But when you got into the holiest of all, you had that golden altar of incense right before it, and then you had the Ark of the Covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had the manna and Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. Now, 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 19, that tells us that when the temple was built, Solomon's temple was built, that all that was in the Ark of the Covenant was the two tablets of stone on which were the Ten Commandments. That's all that was in there. This seems to tell us that there was more in there, the golden pot of manna and Aaron's rod that budded, but then there may be a different way of reading it too. When he says, in which were the golden pot that had the manna and Aaron's rod, he may be talking about in the holy place, in which, in the holy, most holy place, these things were. And that part we know to be true. In Exodus chapter 16, verses 32 and 33, when the children of Israel started getting manna, The Bible doesn't tell us it was a golden pot, but the Bible tells us that God told the people to gather some of that into a pot and set it in the tabernacle before the Lord, the Ark of the Covenant, set it before the Lord so that in future days the children of Israel would remember that God provided them manna in the wilderness for 40 years. And then in Numbers chapter 17, verses 1 through 11, after Moses had dealt with some squabbles about his power, about his authority, God said, I'll tell you what you do. You get somebody from every tribe, the leader of every tribe, to bring his rod. In those days, you know, you'd carry your rod as something for stable for walking, and it performed other functions with it. It was a sign of your power, like a scepter for a king. Get all those leaders of those tribes to bring their rod, and get Aaron to bring his rod for the tribe of Levi, and put all those before the Lord. And in the morning, the one that blossoms is the one to whom I give my authority. And in the morning, Aaron's rod was the one that budded and blossomed, and so rebellion, at least for the time, was put down. That blossoming rod then was kept before the Lord throughout the ages, if not in the Ark of the Covenant, at least right close by in the most holy place, in the Holy of Holies. And above it were the cherubim of glory, verse 5. The other places we see cherubim in the Bible are 1 Samuel chapter 4, verse 4, God rides upon the cherubim. Simply says, in relation to the moving of the Ark of the Covenant, God rides upon the cherubim. In Exodus chapter 24, verse 10, there's a picture of God sitting on a sea of glass, a sea of sapphire. That picture is elucidated a little bit more in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 1, and then later chapter 10, where Ezekiel sees a vision of God. And I don't have time to describe it all to you right now. But in its very basics, it was four living creatures, each that had four different kinds of faces, each that were running back and forth as if lightning and torches in fire, each that had a wheel, a very high and awesome wheel beside it, whose rim was full of eyes. And those beings in Ezekiel chapter 10 were called cherubim. Then above those beings was that sea of glass, and on top of it was the throne of God, that had all kinds of glory and beauty emanating from it. Now, with all that in mind, very quickly, without a detailed study, because you could spend hours and hours and hours and hours researching chapter 9, verses 1 through 5, but I hope that we've done just enough to impress this upon us. God is glorious. When he said to make a tabernacle for him in Old Testament times, he didn't say, find some 2x4s and throw something up that looks like a shed in your backyard. He said you use the best materials. You do it exactly as I tell you. You cover all these things with gold. I want the very best because I am the best. God deserves the best in worship. There's one lesson we can get out of the Old Testament there. That earthly sanctuary had to be the best and it had to be respected. Sometimes maybe we don't respect our worship enough in the heavenly sanctuary, if you will, the church, not the church building, but wherever the church meets. When we worship God, there ought to be respect, and we ought to do it according to the pattern of the first century. Then, in verses 6 through 10, he goes on to speak a little bit about more of the intent of the activity that they had in this Old Testament tabernacle. Verse 6, now when these things have been thus prepared, the priests always went into the first part of the tabernacle performing the services. The priests could go in and out of the holy place, and they would do that to perform the services they were supposed to perform, taking care of the showbread, taking care of the oil for the lamps, taking care of the altar of incense. But into the second part, the most holy of holies, the high priest went alone once a year on the 10th day of the 7th month, according to Leviticus 16, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the people's sins committed in ignorance. I read over Leviticus 16 often because some of it seems a little anachronistic to me. Some of it seems a little bit out of order. But I think that I've got something of the picture of what happened on that day, and so I'll try to summarize it for you, but you, as always, check me later. On the 10th day of the 7th month, the high priest was to gather certain animals. He was to gather a bull for a sin offering for himself and a ram for a burnt offering for himself, because he was a sinner as well. And then he was to gather two goats as sin offerings for the people and a ram as a burnt offering for the people. It seems to me that first he was to kill the bull and then take the blood of the bull with a cloud of incense into the most holy place and sprinkle some of that blood with his fingers on the east side of the mercy seat and on the north side of the mercy seat, if I remember correctly. And then he was supposed to go back out. And at that time, he would separate the goats and he would kill one of the goats, which was a sin offering for the people, and bring that blood in and do with it as he did with the blood of the bull for his own sin offering and sprinkle some of it on the mercy seat. That's where mercy took place. That's where justification took place. That's where God demanded justification by blood, and that was the symbolism that was given to the people. After that, he would go back out and he would lay his hands on the remaining goat, the live goat, and then send it off into the wilderness with somebody else to allow that goat to go free. And this was a symbol of that goat taking the burden of the people's sins. But you see what it's doing? It's not taking away the sins permanently. It's taking away the sins temporarily. That goat is still out there somewhere, and he's not put to death. Then after he did that, he was supposed to change his clothes and wash, and then he was supposed to come out to the altar of burnt offering at the front of the tabernacle or later temple complex and offer that ram as a burnt offering for himself and offer that ram as a burnt offering for the people. And he was to burn the fat of the sin offerings on that altar there, and then the rest of the animal was to be taken outside the camp and burned there. All of that to show the people, you've sinned, I want to do something about your sin, but it's not an easy thing. Maybe, I don't know, I didn't think through this before I stood up here, but maybe our world would think a little bit more about sin if we could find some way for them to ponder what the Jewish people had to go through for 1,500 years because of sins. It was serious. Every day there were some sort of sin offerings and trespass going on. And then you come to this Day of Atonement and you have to do all of this about your sins. Nobody likes to be around a whole lot of blood. Nobody likes to be around the stench that would be there. Flesh burning on fire every day, you wouldn't like that. It's all a reminder that we are wicked in the sight of God. But today we're so flippant about it. Even in the church sometimes, we're just so flippant about sin. We don't care. We'll think this, oh, we'll be all right because we go to church and we don't care the rest of the week. We don't even adjust our world views to accommodate what the Bible says about things, even though we sit in church sometimes. We don't think that much about sin. Well, you probably do, but as a society, we don't think nearly enough about sin. But these Jewish people, as wicked as they had become on this Day of Atonement, they could not avoid being confronted with their own sin and knowing that it was not yet fully taken away. Every year, it was not done with. It was not over. Because, verse 8, the Holy Spirit indicating this, that the way into the holiest of all, the most holy place, was not yet made manifest while the first tabernacle was still standing. As long as that first tabernacle, or we might add from context, any likeness of it, those temples, was still standing, there really wasn't any way into the holiest of all. Now, I need to correct myself. When Christ died about 30 AD and then resurrected and ascended to heaven, then the way into the holiest of all was made ready for Christians about that time, and the temple wouldn't be destroyed until 70 AD. That's the meaning of Hebrews chapter 8 when he says that which has become obsolete is growing old and ready to vanish away. There was that transitory period, but as the overall period in the scheme of the world, you can see what he means. While the first tabernacle, maybe just the original, or even almost the rest of the temples, as long as that's still standing, the way into the real holiest of all was not opened yet. It was symbolic, verse 9, for the present time, or the time that then was present, says the King James, I believe, in which both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make him who performed the service perfect in regard to the conscience, concerned only with foods and drinks, various washings, and fleshly ordinances imposed until the time of Reformation. You have two periods there. The present time, where he's writing, where at the temple there were still people who were offering animal sacrifices. Even those animal sacrifices were null and void at that time. They were still offering them. That's the present. The time of Reformation would be this new era, the Christian era in which we live. There's that transitory period there, but the two periods are distinct in this writing, in this mind right here. those people who were still offering those sacrifices at the temple, those sacrifices could never cleanse their conscience because they weren't sufficient. Even during the Old Testament's validity, they weren't sufficient to completely cleanse the conscience. The way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest. Verse 11. But Christ came as high priest, not after those Levites, but after the order of Melchizedek. Christ came as high priest of the good things to come with the greater and more perfect tabernacle. Watch this. Not made with hands. That is, not of this creation. This tabernacle is not one that anybody made with a hammer or a saw or a nail or even a wood peg. This tabernacle was not made even being fitted together silently as the old temple was. This tabernacle was not made with anything that could be seen with man's hands. It's a spiritual thing. As Christ said, his church, his kingdom was spiritual in John 18, verse 36. Christ came as high priest of the good things to come with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is not of this creation, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood. Can you imagine a high priest coming to the temple on the Day of Atonement one day and somebody asking him, where's the ram? Where's the bull? Where are the two goats? Well, I don't have them. Well, what's your plan today, sir? I plan to offer myself and have somebody sprinkle my blood for the forgiveness of these people. Well, we can imagine that in our minds. We can compare it. But here's what Christ did. He came through the old covenant. He kept that old covenant perfectly so that nobody ever had to offer a sacrifice on his behalf. There was never a sin offering, a trespass offering that he had to offer because he sinned. There's never anything he had to do like that because of his own stubborn will or his own violation of God's law. And so his blood was perfect. The blood of a lamb was perfect in some sense because, well, it couldn't sin. The blood of a bull was perfect in some sense because it couldn't sin. But Christ was better because he, human being with free will, could have sinned, yet did not. So that then people could come and not have to be stuck in the 1500-year pattern of another rollover of sin, if you will. He said, I'm going to die once for all and get this over with. That's the reason we don't offer animal sacrifices today. He came with his own blood. He entered the most holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. Remember Hebrews chapter 6, verses 19 and 20? This hope we have is an anchor of the soul, where the forerunner has entered for us, even Jesus, who went through the veil. I forget the exact wording, but that's the case. This hope we have is an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, which enters the presence behind the veil, where the forerunner has entered for us, even Jesus, having become high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. He went through the veil for us with his own blood. Verse 13, for if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh, you know, that was some sort of fleshly thing being done there. You still didn't get to the spirit. You still had your bad conscience. How much more, an argument from the lesser to the greater, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal spirit offered himself without spot. Those lambs had to be without spot and blemish physically. Christ was without spot and blemish spiritually. Who offered himself without spot to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God. Someone asked, what is a dead work? It's any work that's done without Christ in mind. But now you have your conscience cleansed of those because this forgiveness is once and for all. And for this reason, verse 15, he is the mediator of the new covenant by means of death for the redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant. Those people that had to wait and had to wait, they had to die waiting. But when Christ died, somehow for a God who's timeless, the blood also covered their sins if they were faithful to him as well. For the redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant, that those who are called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. Verse 16, for where there is a testament, there must also of necessity be the death of the testator, for a testament is in force after men are dead, since it has no power at all while the testator lives. Now, while those people were living under the Old Testament law, Christ's death meant nothing to them. In the time frame that humans know, Christ's death meant nothing to them. Christ's instructions meant nothing to them because he hadn't come yet. He hadn't died yet. He hadn't been buried. Even when Christ was on the earth, He was following the Old Testament law. He was following the law of Moses, and his instructions for New Testament worship, like the first day of the week, like partaking of the Lord's Supper, like giving, like praying, like worshiping, like we do on the first day of the week, his instructions for the church with elders and deacons, none of that applied back while he was on the earth because he lived under that Old Testament law. What did it take for him to come and put that New Testament law into effect? It was his will and testament. And a will and testament is not in effect until somebody who wrote it dies. And when he died, and then was resurrected again, and Peter preached on the day of Pentecost. I know there's some transitory time in there I don't know how to deal with, but I don't need to know how to deal with it because God knows how to deal with it. That's when his will became into effect. So, the instructions that I have in the New Covenant era were not those instructions they had in the Old Covenant era. And those instructions that I have now about how to be saved were not the instructions that were even the instructions when Christ was on the earth or where Christ was on the cross. And you know what that means, don't you? People say, I want to be saved like the thief on the cross. Well, you can't be. Because you don't live in the same age that he did. You don't live in the same era that he did. He lived under the Old Testament law. Christ said to him that day, today you will be with me in paradise. Effectively, we assume, pronouncing some salvation on him. And people say, well, wait a minute. He didn't have to be baptized. Well, no, he didn't. He didn't have to be baptized in the name of Christ because nobody did yet. While he was on the earth, Christ's will hadn't come into effect yet. You or I cannot possibly be saved like the thief on the cross was saved. Christ's will is in effect now, and he has given the terms of it in faith, repentance, confession, and baptism, and faithful living, and that thief didn't have any of that to live under. He may have been baptized by John's baptism, which was relevant for a few months before Christ's ministry, and a few years before Christ died. We don't know for sure. But the thief on the cross has nothing to do with my salvation. The will and the covenant that was given has something to do with my salvation, and I want to follow it. Verse 18, therefore not even the first covenant was dedicated without blood. Blood was the important thing here. When Moses dedicated the first covenant in Exodus chapter 24, he took blood and he sprinkled it on the people. And he sprinkled it, we'll find out here, on the books as well. And he sprinkled it on the furnishings. Not all of that is recorded in Exodus, but some of it is revealed here. For when Moses had spoken every precept, verse 19, to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and goats with water, scarlet wool and hyssop, those were often used, mixed with blood in the Old Testament, and sprinkled both the book in itself and all the people, saying, this is the blood of the covenant which God has commanded you. Then likewise he sprinkled with blood both the tabernacle and all the vessels of ministry. And according to the law, almost all things are purified with blood, and without shedding of blood there is no remission. That ought to make me want to press forward in my Christian walk the best I can, because it took Christ's blood to get me to this point. And every time I mess up, it takes his blood again. The blood of Christ cleanses us, 1 John chapter 1, verse 7. But I ought not want to have to make it cleanse me. I ought to try to live the very best that I can. Therefore, verse 23, it was necessary that the copies of the things in the heavens. It's interesting here. The things that came first were copies of the real thing in heaven. Things that came first as we know them. But before these things came, the real thing was in heaven. Therefore, they were copies. Therefore, it was necessary that the copies of the things should be purified with these, that is, the blood of animals, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. These heavenly things needed a better sacrifice. They needed better blood. For Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, the tabernacle, the temple, which are copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Not that he should offer himself often as the high priest, often, as the high priest enters the most holy place every year with the blood of another. Christ is not going to have to come back and do that every year. He then would have had to suffer often since the foundation of the world. Can you imagine if Christ would have had to come every year and suffer like he did? Nobody would want that for him, except the most hardened atheist, most hardened hater of God. He then would have had to suffer often since the foundation of the world, but now, once at the end of the ages, that is, we're in the last ages since Christ. So once at the end of the ages, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Those copies led us to understand what is true and what is real. I have no way to explain them to you other than words. Oh, I could put pictures up here, but people have put the pictures up there based on the words. Words are what God used to tell us about these spiritual things. Maybe that's why Jesus in the book of John is called the Word. He's the communication from God for everything that our unseen spirit needs. Then it all gets really real, if you will, in the last two verses of the chapter. And as it is appointed for men to die once, and after this the judgment. You know, at funerals, sermons, a lot of people quote that verse. And it's okay to quote that verse by itself. That's fine. I do it myself sometimes. But we must not forget that it is only a portion of the sentence. It's only sort of the if part of the sentence. There's a then part that comes after it. And as it is appointed for men to die once, but after this the judgment, so Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. To those who eagerly wait for him, he will appear a second time, apart from sin, for salvation. He came because of sin the first time. The next time he'll come for judgment and to take those who have taken advantage of the sacrifice for his sin back home to be with him. There's so many other things we could mention in there. I have to give you these two real quickly as a reminder. One, there's never going to be a reestablishment of sacrifices after this earth as we know it ends. There's not going to be another earth. There's not going to be a continuation of earth. There's not going to be a reestablishment of sacrifices with a throne in Jerusalem. Christ died once for all. Secondly, Christ is coming once more. And that's it. The premillennial theory says he's coming silently at the beginning of the rapture, coming again at the end of the rapture, end of the tribulation period, and then coming again at the end of the or being here for 1,000 years. Got all kinds of comings of Christ. He's only coming once more. And that'll be the end of time. Are you eagerly looking forward to it? Did you see how he said that? To those who eagerly wait for him, he will appear a second time. Now, he'll appear a second time for everybody. But for those who eagerly wait for him, he will appear a second time apart from sin for salvation. Have you taken him up on his offer of salvation? He shed his blood for you, and you can be washed in the blood of the Lamb. Revelation chapter 1, verse 5. But he tells us how to do that. You contact his blood and his death where he died, and you're buried into his death in baptism. Romans chapter 6 and Acts chapter 22, verse 16. So when you're baptized into Christ, you contact that blood, so to speak, figuratively, which everything here is figurative, but very real. You contact that blood of Christ, and then you're raised to walk in newness of life. You've had your faith in Christ. You've confessed him. You've repented of your sins. You've been baptized for the remission of sins, and then you start anew. And if you walk in the light as he is in the light, even if you stumble, his blood will continue to cleanse you, 1 John chapter 1, verse 7. But if you turn away from him, there's no more sacrifice for sins, Hebrews 10, verse 26. If you've done that, you need to come back with repentance and prayer. If we could help you, please come as we stand and sing.